Well, President Trump has managed to dominate most of our news broadcasts throughout this last week, hasn't he? Whether he's been talking about torture, trade, or the Great Wall on the Mexican border. A source close to the president, well, Melinda Hendry to be precise, pointed out to me something you may not have spotted, though, that at his Inauguration Day service, the preacher, Robert Jeffress, said this: "When I think of you, President-elect Trump, I'm reminded of another great leader God chose thousands of years ago in Israel. The nation had been in bondage for decades, the infrastructure of the country was in shambles, and God raised up a powerful leader to restore the nation. And the man God chose was neither a politician nor a priest. Instead, God chose a builder whose name was Nehemiah. And the first step of rebuilding the nation was the building of a great wall. God instructed Nehemiah to build a wall around Jerusalem to protect its citizens from enemy attack. You see, God is not against building walls." Well, if, as we are, we're going to head back the best part of 2,500 years over these next 5 Sundays, it is good to know the story is still relevant and up to date. However, I think we're going to have to work a little harder and a little better to discover what Nehemiah really has to teach our day. Now, of course, in many people's minds, he is linked to rebuilding walls, and for good reasons. Many churches have turned to the book of Nehemiah when they launch building projects. But bear in mind, the walls are built, they're done and dusted before you get halfway through the book. Others see this as a great book on leadership. And one of the things I love about the Old Testament is, when it tells it histories, it does so in a way that gives you space to explore themes like that. But it's no more a leadership training handbook than it is a construction manual. It's the story of God and his people. And its lessons are lessons about God and for his people. Actually, if you want to really understand it, our Old Testament could almost be designed to fool us, because Nehemiah appears right in the middle of the Old Testament, while the events it describes really come at the very end. Israel, both the north and south kingdoms, have been sent into exile. But when the Babylonian Empire fell to the Persians, a new policy came into force as the Persians began repatriating the exiles. That's not Bible fantasy, by the way. That is Bible history supported by archaeology. And you can see some of the archaeology on the tour of the British Museum next Sunday. So, by the time we come to Nehemiah, the temple has been rebuilt, a shadow of the original maybe, but real and there nonetheless. Ezra, closely linked to Nehemiah, has returned too. But the story opens with Nehemiah hundreds of miles away from Jerusalem in Susa. He has a family visit from a brother and some friends. They've traveled east to see him because Nehemiah is one of those who have not yet gone back. And as I picked up the book and started reading, the first thing that stood out for me was this, that Nehemiah's a man of passion. A man of passion. Look at those opening verses. The friends bring in the latest news. What's going on in Jerusalem? Verse 3, "The wall of Jerusalem is broken down. Its gates have been burnt with fire." Verse 4, "When I heard these things, I sat down and wept." Now, I better come clean. I am a buttoned-up Brit, so when tears come, you know, I'm reaching for the Kleenex, I'm looking the other way, I'm trying embarrassedly to change the subject. The point here, though, is not actually anything to do with the Kleenex or whether you wear your heart on your sleeve. It's where's our passion? You know, I sometimes think I have an emotional bandwidth that's about kind of that broad around the sort of midpoint. I was talking with Claire at breakfast about people who I don't think that they ever cross my bandwidth. You know, they're either right out there or right out there, and sometimes they seem to be able to do both at once. It's wonderful. My instinctively dispassionate approach serves well in many situations, but leaves me ungodly in others. Gordon McConville writes of the Nehemiah verse 4, it's the trauma of one who's made God's cause his own and who sees it scorned. There is a spirit today which passes for broad-mindedness and tolerance, but which is really indifference to the hastening of God's kingdom in the world. I read that and I thought, ouch, that's too close to home for my comfort. Now, many things are probably stirring Nehemiah's passions. Family and friends left so vulnerable. I mean, walls mattered. They were a bit like an army. You know, without them, you were open to all kinds of attacks. God's people being so feeble. They'd known judgment and exile, but this hardly sounds like the promised returning and rebuilding. What does that say about God's people? Well, in trouble and disgrace. What does it say about God's name and reputation? Can he really restore his people? And then what about Jerusalem, the city of God, the light for the nations, the vital to his witness? Rebuilding the walls would be, well, today we'd probably speak about rebuilding the church's witness. When did we last shed a tear? Have our passions stirred by the state of God's church, God's people, God's work? When did the state of God's church drive us to pray? Never mind to tears. The dwindling numbers. Now, maybe not in London, but go across the breadth of the rest of the country, and that's where all the stats point. The vulnerability to an increasingly hostile culture. I was listening on the radio in the middle of the week to Libby Purvis conducting a very friendly interview with Milton Jones, the comedian. And about two-thirds of the way through the interview, she just threw in a perfectly friendly manner, she said, was it hard to come out as a Christian? What a striking phrase, wasn't it? Is it hard to come out as a Christian? As the Christian voice gets marginalized and squeezed out of the public square and we struggle to speak into it from weakness and vulnerability, does it stir us? The uncertain sound and muddled message that often does come from church spokesmen and women, the generations growing up with no gospel in home or school, or tragically, sometimes even church, I'm short on tears. Does it worry you? Nehemiah's story is the story of concern for God's people and what it led him to do. The wall spoke of safety and security, but it also began to give a corporate identity, and Nehemiah would be building that as they worked and then as the people were taught and built up afterwards. And life, I know, is full and busy for us, but it was full and busy for Nehemiah too, as we'll see. And it began here for Nehemiah. So do we share his passion? A passion that puts us to work building up God's people. Hundreds of you are doing just that across the All Souls Ministries and way, way beyond. Others of us maybe need to pray we grow a use for the Kleenex. A man of passion. What you can't miss in chapter 1 is that he's also a man of prayer. See verse 4, for some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Now, Nehemiah is not a priest and he's not a preacher, but he prayed. Do not leave praying to the professionals. Nehemiah is not old and past it, and at least you can pray, dear. And he prayed. Now, my knee-jerk reaction, if I'd heard the news he'd got, I think would have been to start planning what we could do, what obstacles we'd have to get over, who we'd need to approach, what favors to call in. Nehemiah knew all of that. He is the supreme activist. He's a goal-setting, go-getting doer, the ultimate organizer and administrator. But he began by praying. And the lesson's obvious. It's just I constantly struggle to learn it. And I'd be surprised if many of you don't have the same struggle. You know, prayer is a better way to start the day than emails or Facebook or the news. Too busy to pray on your own? Too busy to come together on Tuesday to pray? Almost certainly too busy. It was way back in the middle of the last century, actually. I remember hearing someone read a snippet of it before I was converted, and later on I got the book after I was converted and read it. And Pam Glover, our resources manager, say that people still at regular intervals buy copies of David Wilkerson's The Cross and the Switchblade. Some of you will know it. It was the story of a pastor's reaching out into the gangs of New York City. But the story begins when Wilkerson turns off his television and prays for an hour each night. Nehemiah prayed. And when he prays, you see, he knew his God. Look at verse 5. O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God. He feared God. The wonderful Christian privilege, isn't it, is that we can call God Father. But this is our Father, the great and awesome God. Get God right, and we'll get ourselves, we'll get God's people, we'll get our world in the right perspective. You know, Brexit, presidents, Trump and Putin, they'll all be put into perspective. He feared God. More than that, he trusted God. You see how he goes on in verse 5, the great and awesome God who keeps his covenant of love. He prays to a God who keeps his promises and sticks to his agreements. I mean, how do you pray without that? What do you pray without that? There's a point to prayer because we pray to a God who can be trusted. He knew his God and he knew his sin. Look, verse 6, I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. He doesn't distance himself from others. Would have been very easy to do. Here is confession for hundreds of years of rebellion, and he doesn't excuse himself. He doesn't talk about them back then or them over there in Jerusalem. No, it is we have acted very wickedly. We have not obeyed. He doesn't point to others and confess their sins. You know that neat way some of us preachers have of doing that. He identifies with a sinful people. He knew his God, he knew his sin, he knew his Bible. He's not a priest or a preacher, but he still knows his Bible and his theology. Chapters like Deuteronomy 30 with its curses and blessings, or Ezekiel 36, which echoes the ideas of judgment and scattering, the exile they've been through, but also for those who repent, the restoring and rebuilding. He's not a priest or a preacher, but he knows his Bible. And his theology doesn't just fill his head, it shapes his heart. Have you got there yet? He knew his God, he knew his sin, he knew his Bible, he knew to be the answer to his own prayer. You can work without praying, said Hudson Taylor, the great missionary, but that's a bad plan. You cannot pray without working. And as Nehemiah comes to the end of his prayer, he's still seeking the Lord. Verse 10, Lord, let your ear be attentive to your servant, but he also clearly has some plan in mind. You see it there in verse 11? Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. Which actually, when I first read it, I thought was a bit of an anticlimax. And, you know, this great prayer, And it just builds up to asking for some strange man to do Nehemiah a favor. And then you read the punchline. I was cupbearer to the king. That's the man he's going to approach. See, Nehemiah's not a priest or a preacher, but he's going to use his position, his gifts, his influence to help God's people. He's planning to go back to Jerusalem, but he's not a free agent. He's going to have to apply for a transfer. And don't be fooled by the cupbearer word. It doesn't speak of some minor lackey, you know, of a wine waiter. Now, the cupbearer was an important bodyguard, the ultimate security for the king against poisoning. He tasted the food and drink first. But in a court full of intrigue, whether real or imagined, where paranoia could easily reign, the cupbearer was often a highly trusted advisor. See, think about it. He's got no eyes on the throne for himself. There's no way anyone's ever going to make the cupbearer king. And he has every reason to keep the king from making the kind of decisions that make the kind of enemies who try to poison the king. See, he's the one person you can rely on to give sound, impartial advice. He is, in effect, a senior civil servant. And he wants out. And more than that, he wants out to do something which the king had banned just a few years previously. See, there's another bit of background information you need to shape your understanding of this book. There had been a previous attempt to rebuild Jerusalem, and it led to a complaint to the king that the city had a history of rebellion and revolt and should not be strengthened. And in Ezra chapter 4, we discover the king did his research, agreed with them. He wrote back, halting the building work immediately. Jerusalem was not to be rebuilt until I so order. That's what he wrote. And that was the tiny loophole, until I so order, that Nehemiah was trying to squeeze through. No wonder he's praying, give me success today. Nehemiah's going to turn his back on the comfort and security of Susa, the prominence of his position, the guaranteed flow of good wine. He'll throw in his lot with the disgraced rebels of Jerusalem. Of course, if materialistic comforts shape our life priorities instead, it's not Nehemiah, but Christ we have to check if we're following. And Nehemiah's passion reevaluates his priorities. He sees things as God sees them. God is a great and awesome God. Well then, despot King Artaxerxes, who holds Nehemiah's life in his hands, he's only this man. Despots, presidents, prime ministers, the company, the business, work as well as hobbies, interests that they're put in their place. God is a great and awesome God. Then Nehemiah, the influential civil servant, like any important executive, busy, hard-pressed manager, ambitious CEO, is just your servant. See, I wonder if our passions or our prayers help us to see our world as God sees it. And if so, I wonder where that might lead us. The man of passion is a man of prayer. He's also a man of purpose. Now, it quickly becomes obvious that Nehemiah is more than just an ideas man. He can turn ideas into action. He's the completer finisher as well. Watch him at work as we speed through chapter 2. You'll see his patience right at the very beginning. It begins in the month of Nisan, which is some 4 months on from chapter 1. 4 months asking God, give your servant success today. Few of us, I suspect, are naturally patient, but we can't read the Bible and still cling to some idea of a God of the instant. But with his patience, he did have courage. When the opportunity comes, I was very much afraid, verse 2. No real surprise there. And verse 4, the king said to me, what is it you want? And then I prayed to the God of heaven. And I doubt it was anything long or theological or like the prayer of chapter 1. I suspect it probably didn't go much beyond help. Let me say, those are very useful prayers to pray. And most of us find many occasions we need to pray them. There isn't time for much more than help. Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. And you discover in the background there's all kinds of planning that's happening. All that waiting time hadn't been wasted time for Nehemiah. He knows what he wants. He knows what he needs. He'd used those months to think through, work out, plan it thoroughly. At least I find it hard to think it all spurted out spontaneously. Verse 6, the request for a sabbatical, a new planting for a few months or years. Verse 7, the letters, he needs a safe conduct. Verse 8, other letters, and he knows who he needs them for to get the timber that's wanted. The military escort, yes please. I don't know if you've got a spirituality, a walk with God that allows God to put inspired words in your mouth. I don't know if you've had that experience. Just occasionally I say something, and then I have to say it again, not because I think the other person hasn't listened, but I'm still trying to source it. I mean, that was far too wise to be me. But I had just prayed, give me wisdom, Lord. And, you know, about the third time round, I work out that he answered the prayer. But I hope your spirituality, your walk with the Lord, is not invalidated by planning. Spontaneous prayer and careful planning can both be the mark of a servant of God. It's no surprise that the planning goes on when he gets to Jerusalem and his preparation. There's a secrecy about his visit, a danger, of course, to rebuilding the rebel city. So he does his own survey of the walls. Sees for himself what he's taking on. He goes by night. He's just got a trusted few with him. And only then does he recruit others and mobilizes them, makes his presentation. In verse 17, you see the trouble we're in. Come, let's rebuild. We'll no longer be in disgrace. And you notice it's we. It's not you. It's not, look, I've traveled all this way. Now I can see what a mess you are in. No, he identifies. He's one of them. So that we will no longer be in disgrace. And they replied, let's start rebuilding. And immediately as they began this good work, Nehemiah tells us of opposition. Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, they'll obstruct the work all the way through the book. They're mocking and ridiculing now. See, a good work, a building God's people work, a God work, will always face opposition. When God's ultimate servant, who came and identified with his people, who came to do God's ultimate disgrace-removing work, the perfect plan, perfectly executed, Jesus met with opposition and hostility throughout his ministry. Don't expect it to be any different for us. It's always like that. And Nehemiah faces them down in verse 20. And so at the annual church meeting, someone loyally stands up to thank Nehemiah for his leadership. You know, we couldn't have done it without you. No other leader could have pulled it off. You were the man for the job. And judging by the applause, there may have been plenty of truth in it, but they missed the truth that Nehemiah grasped from the start. Because he said, the God of heaven will give us success. The God of heaven will give us success. It was because Nehemiah turned to him, the God of heaven, that he left his comfort zone. That he saw how to use his workplace skills and influence for the good of God's honor and God's people. We certainly need to look to him as well. I mean, who knows where that'll take us? It took Nehemiah away from home for months, if not years, to do very practical work. It may take us there. It may leave us closer to home, because there's plenty to be done here, building up God's people. It may just be an extra pair of hands in the mountaineer group, our children with additional needs, wonderful way of protecting them, great way of allowing parents and family to be built up. Or it may be Dan Wells is regularly telling me of people who'd love to be in a fellowship group where they can support and build each other up. He's got plenty of people, but not enough leaders. And it's not because we don't have enough people with the ability to lead. All of this could be racing far too far ahead. Many of us, we will need to begin by crying to God for that passion which took Nehemiah to his knees in the first place. So before we just stand and sing of our dependence on a God as a shield and a defender, why don't we be quiet and face God ourselves and begin to cry to him for passion, for purpose? Let's be still and pray.